5. Martin didn't know what his next move would be, but he knew he'd have to make it in the next 5 seconds. He was flying as fast as he dared, at an altitude of 7 feet above the forest floor, high enough to not get caught in the undergrowth, but low enough to avoid getting hung up in the canopy. He held his staff in front of him, tilted so as to be parallel to his body. The last thing he needed was his staff slamming into a tree trunk, sending him falling in a heap to the ground. He couldn't slow down because one of his pursuers was flying right behind him. Martin was sure he was losing ground, since he had to find his way through the trees, while all his attacker had to do was follow him and fly through the Martin-shaped hole. Martin would have just flown straight up, punching through the canopy and emerging into the clear blue sky above, except that he knew there was a second pursuer lurking up there, waiting for Martin to emerge into the open, presenting a clear target. Martin glanced upward and saw a black shape moving fast above the treetops. He lowered his gaze just in time to see and almost dodge a dead limb hanging limply from the live branches that supported its weight. He tried to swoop under it, but wasn't quite fast enough. It grazed painfully across his back, then fell to the forest floor. In an act of hopefulness, Martin glanced behind him and cursed when he saw the purple blur that was gaining on him zip right over the top of the fallen branch without having to alter course or even decelerate. He knew from memory that a river cut through the woods and that he'd be reaching it soon. He would lose his cover and be a sitting duck for the bogey above the trees. If, on the other hand, he slowed enough to turn away from the river, the purple blur behind him would overtake him and knock him out of the air. To make matters worse, there was a third attacker out there somewhere who had been delayed at the start of the chase, but would certainly be back into the fray by now. Martin only had himself to blame. He had gotten so caught up in the excitement of having a trainee that he'd forgotten that there were people who would attack him on sight. The day had started on such a positive note. Martin awoke to find that Roy was already up. Martin produced breakfast for them, and while Roy was amusingly disturbed to eat food that had been pulled out of a wizard's hat, he was clearly equally disturbed that the breakfast consisted of a McDonald's bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit and a solid slab of hash browns. Once breakfast was done, Martin set about getting Roy up to speed. Martin showed Roy his top-of-the-line 2012 laptop, which, since Roy was from 1973, was as astonishing to him as any magic trick Martin had done. Martin explained that until recently, the wizards from farther in the future had tried to keep later technology from the earlier wizards in the interest of not messing up the timeline more than they had to, but that recent events had shown that this put earlier wizards at an unfair disadvantage, and that the timeline didn't seem to care what they did. Roy asked Martin to explain that last part, and Martin explained that most wizards went back to their original time on a regular basis, and that nobody had found a single change, no matter what the wizards did in the past. He briefly explained the two predominant theories— that they existed in a separate timeline created by whatever program used the file, or that at some point in the future, something would happen to clean up the mess they were currently making. Martin trailed off when it became clear that Roy had lost interest in the philosophical discussion and just wanted to play with Martin's computer. Maybe we'll get along after all, Martin thought. Once Roy was done boggling over Martin's laptop, Martin explained about the Shell program, the interface that Philip and the former chairman Jimmy had developed to make it easy to utilize the file that brought them all here. He explained to Roy the powers that the Shell could bestow upon anyone who knew that it existed and took the time to learn how to use it. He told Roy that he need not age. He'd never be too cold or too hot again. He could speak any language fluently. Most important, he explained that while he still needed food, water, and air, he was impervious to physical damage. If Roy wore a robe and hat that met certain measurements exactly, the Shell would recognize him as a wizard, and he'd have the powers of flight, teleportation, and the ability to create food, money, and almost anything else out of thin air. Martin also promised Roy that when his training was complete and he'd passed his trials, that Martin would set him up with a laptop so that he could go back to his own time at will if he wanted.
That's if you accept the training. If you choose not to, I'll just assume you're up to no good and send you back home so the CIA can pick you up. So, Roy, do you accept the training?
With a sales pitch like that, Roy didn't have to think long. Martin spent a little time at the computer, getting Roy set up in the shell. Then Martin announced that it was time to go. There had been some unpleasantness a while back, and now he and a few of his wizard friends were making a point of getting together once a week to compare notes and share new shell scripts they'd devised that could be used in an emergency. He brought Roy along so he could meet the guys and see what kind of things they'd been working on. Having worked in the defense industry, he might find it interesting. Martin and Roy materialized in the middle of a large clearing about 5 miles away from Leadchurch. Martin's friend Gary had picked it because it was large, flat, and surrounded by thick woods on all sides. The wizards had all the room they needed to demonstrate and test new spells without having to worry about any locals sneaking up on them. Even if someone did sneak up on them from the forest, that person would have to move amazingly fast to reach the middle of the clearing before the wizards could react. Martin, in his silver robe and hat, staff in hand, and Roy, wearing his trench coat, skinny tie, and sensible shoes, stood alone in the middle of the field. Martin spun around, then said,
"Oh no."
A gray shape emerged from the tree line, moving amazingly fast. Two more shapes, one purple, one black, were closing on their position from other directions. Martin remembered Gary proposing a new plan to keep each other on their toes. He called it the Cato Protocol. It was a simple idea. The wizards would attack one another without any provocation or warning. It would ensure that they all stayed in fighting shape. It would force them to be aware of their surroundings. And most important, from Gary's point of view, it would be fun.
"Sounds good," Martin had said. "When do we start?"
"We'll see,"
had been Gary's reply. The streaks of color were almost on top of them when Martin yelled,
"Time out!"
The streaks stopped in midair, floating motionless in a rough triangle around Martin and Roy. Tyler's purple robes hung beneath him, flapping slightly in the breeze. The sun glinted off of the Rolls-Royce hood ornament that topped his staff. Jeff landed, tucking his wand into the pocket of his gray flannel robe. Gary drifted around in front of Martin and Roy. His long, scraggly brown hair jutted out from around his jet-black hat. Beneath the hem of his black robe, his skinny legs and black canvas high tops hung 5 feet above the turf. He pointed the head of his staff, adorned with Kiss action figures, toward Roy and said,
"Hey, Martin, good to see you. Who's the new guy?"
"Gary, Tyler, Jeff, this is Roy, my trainee. He just arrived last night. He doesn't have any powers yet and doesn't know what's going on, so it would be really unfair to attack him."
Despite his clear age difference and uptight demeanor, the three younger wizards welcomed Roy in a genuinely friendly manner. Martin was relieved to note that despite Roy's age, cultural background, and year of origin, he didn't seem to miss a beat when introduced to Tyler, who was possibly the only black man in England at this time in history. They all agreed that they couldn't attack him, since he couldn't really defend himself. Jeff said,
"I could explain to him what's going on, though."
"Good thinking,"
Tyler said, still floating in an aggressive posture.
"That'll free Martin up to be attacked."
"And us to attack him,"
Gary added.
Martin said, "Fair enough."
He blurted out the magic word "floogy" and was off for the tree line like a shot. As he streaked away, a shiny silver ball of speed, he faintly heard Jeff talking to Roy. Martin thought Roy and Jeff would have much to talk about, both being engineers. Martin made a mental note to work on some sort of fast getaway sprint spell to help him really accelerate when he needed to fly away from trouble. Some sort of glowing projectiles flew past Martin, striking the ground in front of him. Martin chose to ignore them, figuring that, like bullets, they were only his problem if they hit him. Martin made it to the tree line with Tyler in hot pursuit. Gary, who had been slower to react, chose to go over the trees and try to head Martin off at the pass, so to speak. Now the pass was in sight. Martin could see a dark shape hanging above the trees, clearly watching him, waiting for him to emerge from the woods. Unless he did something fast, Gary would almost certainly hit him with something. He didn't know what, but knowing Gary, it would be something unpleasant and probably immature. Happily, Martin had been working on a few ideas. He had that big workspace in his warehouse. It'd be a crime not to use it. Martin reached into his pocket and pulled out a small black bean bag. He aimed for a gap in the trees with empty space beyond, looked behind him at Tyler, who was closing fast, slowed a bit, then he tossed the bean bag over his shoulder. It flew in a graceful arc, sailing over Tyler, missing him completely. Martin made a grasping gesture with his right hand and said, "Bamf!" Martin disappeared in a puff of black smoke, which violently dissipated when Tyler flew through it. In the same instant, Martin appeared directly behind Tyler, generating another puff of black smoke. It appeared as if he had materialized and miraculously caught the beanbag. But in truth, his right hand had materialized around the beanbag and the rest of it with him. Martin stopped all forward movement and watched as Tyler flailed, utterly confused by what had just happened. He sailed out of the woods and instantly was struck by a pulse of energy from above. Gary had clearly mistaken Tyler for Martin. For a moment, Tyler spun in the air. Something clearly was wrong. Then Martin saw that a small grayish object of some sort was stuck to the small of Tyler's back, right where he'd been hit. Purple smoke started shooting from the object with quite a bit of force, enough to push Tyler into an uncontrollable spin. The smoke was accompanied by a sound, similar to the sound of a whoopee cushion, but much louder and longer in duration. The purple smoke also had an odor. The odor was familiar and not at all pleasant. Tyler spun in the air like a foul-smelling pinwheel. The whoopee cushion sound was drowned out momentarily by the sound of Tyler cursing at Gary. The thrust from the whoopee rocket stabilized slightly and sent Tyler corkscrewing helplessly into the sky, yelling and cursing as he went. Martin dropped gently to the ground and crouched there in the thicket. He tucked his staff under his left arm and wound up so that he'd be ready to throw his beanbag. Cautiously, Gary dropped below the tree line, looking for Martin. He hovered, staff in one hand, the other hand shading his eyes so he could see into the darkened forest. He expected to find Martin flying above the ground, but it didn't take long to spot Martin's shiny silver robe and hat in the dark brown and green of the woods. It also didn't take long to notice the black object flying very quickly towards him. The beanbag struck Gary painlessly in the chest. A split second later, Martin was there, grasping Gary around the neck with one arm, pulling down with all of his weight. Gary toppled over forward. He found himself beneath Martin, who pushed off from him with both feet, driving him even faster into the ground. Gary hit the ground with great force, while Martin drifted down gently to earth. Gary lay motionless for a moment in the scrub grass along the riverbank. Eyes closed, gathering his strength, hopefully luring Martin in closer. After a carefully timed interval, Gary sprung up into a three-point crouch, his staff held in front of him. His defiant laugh was made less dramatic by the fact that he misjudged Martin's location and had sprung up facing away from Martin. Gary felt something soft hit him in the back, heard Martin say, "Bamf!" Then felt Martin's full weight bear down on his back, buckling his arm and forcing him back into the dirt. "You done?" Martin asked, standing on Gary's back as he lay prone in the dirt.
"Yeah, I guess,"
was Gary's muffled reply. Martin stepped off of his friend and gave him a hand up. He didn't mention that Gary had two big dusty footprints on the back of his robe, and he hoped nobody else would tell him either. They turned their attention to Tyler, who was still creating foul, purple curlicues in the sky. Gary muttered something under his breath, and the smoke and noise let out one last powerful trumpet blast, then stopped. Tyler remained motionless, a dot in the sky, for a moment while he composed himself. When he was ready, he flew to Martin and Gary's position, landing in front of them, glaring at Gary the entire time. After a thick, velvety silence, Tyler asked Gary,
"When will this smell come out of my robe?"
Gary said,
"As soon as you figure out how to make it come out."
"Sorry."
"You will be,"
Tyler said. He then turned his attention to Martin.
"So, what's up with the old guy?"
They were amazed to hear that Roy was from the year 1973, or as Gary put it, pre-Star Wars. Martin told them about how Roy had arrived the night before, copped an attitude, then settled down eventually. He hoped Roy wasn't giving Jeff a hard time. Jeff could be a little sensitive. They took to the air to reconnect with Jeff and Roy. Martin was relieved to find them sitting in the grass, Jeff listening in rapt attention as Roy told him about what it was like to work at the Skunk Works. Now that the pleasantries and the combat were over, they all formally demonstrated the new defensive power they'd brought to share. Gary described what he called his gas jets, which he'd accidentally used on Tyler. Tyler demonstrated his spell by deliberately using it on Gary. Tyler shot him in the back with one of the same glowing bolts Martin had seen whiz past him during their chase. As soon as it hit Gary, he was lifted into the air. Gary swung and lolled sickeningly in space. Clearly, he had no ability to stabilize himself. He was also visibly vibrating as he hung in space, helpless.
"Why?"
Gary whined in a goat-like wavering tone. Tyler walked toward the helpless wizard. He grabbed Gary's leg, stopping his motion. Gary said,
"Thanks."
Tyler said,
"You're welcome,"
and gave him a good hearty spin.
"I'm sure this looks familiar to you all," Tyler said. "The spell lifts the victim 3 feet into the air, drops him, then places him right back there 3 feet above the ground. It does this 10 times a second. The result is that the target is helpless and has no attitude control, although in this case the target had never been able to control his attitude in the first place."
Gary told Tyler to shut up. Tyler shoved Gary with all his might, sending him gliding away from the group, yelling plaintively the whole way. Tyler continued,
"Also, the vibration humiliates the target and almost instantly gives him a splitting headache."
Roy asked,
"Why would you think that would look familiar to us?"
"Oh," Tyler said. "Sorry, Roy. I forgot you were so new. It's based on a spell Martin invented and used in front of all us wizards once."
Roy turned to Martin.
"You invented that? Kiddo, that's diabolical."
Martin shrugged and said,
"Yeah, well, I hope never to have to use it again."
Jeff started to say that this was because Martin had created the spell for his own use, as a crude and utterly failed attempt at a flying spell, but Martin shot him a look that stopped him before he started. In the distance, a weak, warbling voice said,
"Tyler, please stop this."
Tyler yelled,
"Stop it yourself! Any other spell will override it."
Gary said the magic word "floogie" and instantly drifted slowly into the sky, where he hung limply for a moment. Jeff called out,
"Hey, Gary, you okay?"
Gary held up one finger, as if asking for a moment to compose himself. He pointed the finger at Tyler and said,
"Excusee-veen."
A ball of light streaked from his finger. He was far enough away that Tyler had time to react. He hiked up on his wizard staff and swung it like a baseball bat. The silver Rolls-Royce hood ornament traced a glowing arc in the air. The staff connected with the glowing ball, which dissipated on impact. Tyler paused at the end of his follow-through, then craned his head to look at the end of his staff. There, just under the hood ornament, was another of Gary's gas jets. After a half second of silence, the gas jet fired. Martin, Roy, and Jeff all ran as Tyler spun violently, trying to keep his grip on his staff. Soon Tyler was invisible, at the center of a foul-smelling cloud of purple vapor. The wavering sound of the jet and the occasional glint of high-speed chrome were the only indications of the violent activity within the cloud. Finally, Tyler either let go or lost his grip. Either way, his staff soared off into the distance, whirling like a helicopter blade and leaving a purple contrail in its wake. Tyler lay in the grass on his back. Gary approached and offered him a hand up. As he hoisted Tyler to his feet, he said,
"We're even."
"For now," Tyler replied.
Roy shook his head and asked,
"Are you boys sure these spells are meant for self-defense, or are they just designed to help you humiliate each other?"
Gary answered,
"I think a really good spell ought to be able to do both."
At that moment, a subtle, warbling, repetitive chiming noise filled the air. The wizards all cocked their heads to the side. Jeff asked,
"Okay, whose hand is that?"
Everyone but Roy looked at his right hand. Martin said,
"Oh, it's me."
Martin lifted his hand in front of his face. A small, semi-transparent image of Philip's head appeared in the palm of Martin's hand.
"Martin," Philip said, "I need you to come to my shop right now."
"Why?"
Martin asked.
"What is it?"
"I don't know for sure, but I need you to help me figure it out."
Martin said,
"I'll be right there."
Gary leaned in behind Martin's shoulder.
"We'll all be right there."
Philip rolled his eyes.
"Is it too late to say that I want you to come alone?"
Martin said,
"I'll come alone."
Gary said,
"We'll all come alone."